the idea of hotspots is so built into our thinking about crime, spatial patterns of crime, that it's actually quite hard to open up another topic. But Oscar Newman observed in 1972 that the occurrence of crime, which we record with hotspots, is not the same as risk. He pointed out that a busy street may have a higher number of street crimes than a quiet street, and so it would appear as a hotspot. But the much higher movement rates means the risk to individuals is much lower. We've had a very interesting recent study by Valerie Alford on this in part of London. And I suggest that the police need to know about occurrence, hotspots, in order to deploy resources, but potential victims need to know about risk in order to work out strategies of avoidance. Now, the spatial pattern of risk will often take the form of a dispersed pattern of what I call types of location, where local conditions facilitate one crime or another, and won't appear as spatial clusters. Different kinds of crime are, after all, easier in different spatial conditions. Residential burglary benefits from unsurveyed access, street robbery prefers a supply victim one at a time, and so on. So understanding the spatial pattern of risk often means understanding how and where such location types are distributed in the network of public space. Now, a possible tool for looking at this is space syntax, which is a network approach to spatial formal cities, and which characterizes locations numerically in ways which have been shown to reflect other kinds of patterns, such as movement flows, land use mixes, and so on. So using this approach might allow us to relate patterns of crime more precisely to other aspects of city forming life. Now, what I'm going to show today is how the use of space syntax in the study of a large database of residential burglary and street crime against the background of demographic, socioeconomic, and physical data can bring to light some unexpected relations between the physical, spatial, and social characteristics of the built environment and the spatial patterns of risk in these crime types on the other. So what is space syntax? Well, it works first by reducing the street plan of the city to what we call a least line map, which is made up of the fewest lines that cover the system. People worry about these, and they think that it depends on how you draw them. But Turner recently showed that if this map is converted into a graph, following certain rules, treating lines as nodes and intersections as links, there is probably a unique least line graph for any reasonable urban system. I'm not entirely sure of this, but the evidence looks quite suggestive. We then convert the least line map into a graph of segments of lines between intersections. And we assign three different weights to the relationship between adjacent segments. So we take every small segment is our basic use of unit of analysis between junctions. And then we assign weights to the distance between the centres of the adjacent segments, whether or not there's a directional change to another line, and the degree of angular change. We then calculate closeness and betweenness values for each segment with all three weighting separately. This allows us to describe the network in terms of shortest paths, fewest turns paths, and least angle structures from each segment to all others, or if you prefer, in terms of its metric, topological, or geometric structure. We also vary the radius of each segment up to which the measures are calculated, up to the whole system, and define radius also in terms of metric distance, numbers of turns, and degree of change. So we approach this with different ways of weighting the measures, two different kinds of measures, and we vary radius. So it's quite a complex package of measures. We then simplify them by colouring up segments from red for strong values through to blue for weak on whatever measure we're using in order to make the pattern visible. This is a very important aspect of our research, is actually visualising patterns in very complex patterns of space. What you see here is the least angle between this analysis, a part of central London with a radius of 2 kilometres. It would change if we made it 5 kilometres or 250 metres. Now, the relevance of this is these two measures reflect the two components of human movement, the selection of destination and the choice of routes. The closeness of a segment to all others indicates the potential as a destination. Since if we assume by distance decay that human trips are less probable with increasing distance, a segment which is closer to others within a given radius offers more potential as an accessible destination. Practically speaking, you put your shop there in a place that is accessible from as many other points as possible. The betweenness of a segment indicates the degree to which it lies on routes between all pairs of other segments in the system, at up to a radius from that segment. So again, this would guide you in locating your shop. So in this way, space syntax assesses the movement potential of each segment, both as a destination and as a route, using different definitions of distance through the weightings of the shortest path, fewest turns, and least angle change. And all of these have been canvassed by cognitive science as critical for human navigation in complex spatial systems such as cities. Now, what we find through very extensive studies now, three things, that in most circumstances, these spatially defined movement potentials account for about 60% of the differences in pedestrian movement flows on a segment and about 70% of vehicular flows. It varies, of course, depending on how much planning interference has been in the system. But if the system has grown over a period and is reasonably sort of bedded in, then we tend to find this is the case. Secondly, we find that both pedestrian and vehicular movement patterns are best approximated by least angle analysis, and next by fewest turns, and least well by shortest path analysis. We very bad at judging distances, and we use, if you like, angular notions of connectedness as a surrogate for distance calculations. Third thing, and this is very important from the point of view of crime, land use patterns are shaped by the way the urban grid affects movement flows. And this sets in motion a self-organizing process through which the city evolves into its more or less universal form of a network of linked centers and sub-centers set into a background of mainly residential space. So this is, if you like, the analysis of London within the M25. This is the pattern of quite large-scale centres and sub-centres. We're arguing that this is largely responsible for this pattern, for this way in which it shapes movement. And of course, this happens also at a much, much smaller scale. Now, because movement and land use patterns are critical variables in the spatial patterning of crime, either beneficially or negatively, depending on your paradigm, the analysis of movement patterns and potentials provides a powerful and perhaps necessary tool for exploring spatial patterns of crime. So what we do then is that the numerical values this analysis generates then becomes basis of a street segment-based data table to which any number of other numerical variables can be added for each street segment. In this case, crime counts of various kinds, but also demographic, socioeconomic and physical data, such as house types, numbers of stories, existence of back alleys or basements, and so on. In effect, we integrate all the variables on the basis of a spatial description of the street segments, and so arrive at a description of the system as a system of spatial location types plus their functional characteristics. Now, this will allow us to bring greater precision into the relation between crime and where it occurs. The figure above left shows the distribution of street crime over a five-year period in a London borough. The pattern is very strongly linear, as you can see. It almost looks like hot lines rather than hot spots, if you like. And closely follows the analysis which reflected the...
Sorry? What am I looking for here? I see green, yellow, black, red.
Well, you saw this kind of pattern. You saw this is the analysis of the spatial potentials, if you like. You're now seeing this as a background.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's black dots and crime.
Yes, and the red through blue is this sort of the strong and weak values of the space of the segments of space. Okay. And this one over here is residential burglary pattern. And to see this more clearly, I thought I could actually show you this. This is the thing I was showing you. This is the analysis of the through movement potentials, if you like, of the network, and this is the linear pattern of the crime structure. You can just see it immediately that there's a very powerful relationship between these two things, as there is, in fact, in the kind of network of linked centres which have grown up there. If you look at the residential burglary pattern, there seems to be nothing at all. I defy you to see any kind of obvious pattern in that. I'm sure Patricia could, but I think very few other people could actually see these things. So these are my problem. These are my research questions. What the heck are these patterns all about? Can we sort of throw some light on them? Now, what I'm going to do is to present some results from a study funded by the English equivalent National Science Foundation under a project called Sustainable Urban Environments. And what I'm going to keep doing is I'm going to try and address the current debate between two opposed paradigms for designing out crime in urban areas. One stresses open and permeable environments, mixing uses and having higher densities, using the traditional city as its model. The other advocates more closed, relatively impermeable, smaller scale, mono-use, low-density environments, using Oscar Newman's notion of defensible space as its model. In the US, this paradigm goes under the rubric safe space against defensible space. Now, the first paradigm, if you like, is in effect saying more people, having more people around makes you safer, the Jane Jacobs argument. So use spatial design to maximize co-presence and natural surveillance. It's in this way make life more difficult for the criminal. The other is saying that people improve criminals and increasing numbers increases anonymity. So reduce numbers to improve control by the residential community. We call them the open and closed solutions, if you like. Well, I'm going to suggest that each of these views is true, but they're referring to different things. Part of our aim today is to clarify how apparently contradictory propositions drawn from past research go together. Though on other subjects, I think both sides will turn out to be just plain wrong. And it's all about trying to bring this much greater precision into the analysis. So the specific questions I'm aiming to address are, does higher density reduce or induce crime? Does mixed use reduce or induce crime? Do people passing by make you safer or more vulnerable? How permeable should residential areas be? Do social and economic factors interact with physical and spatial factors in crime vulnerability? And I'm going to say in no case is there a simple yes-no answer to these questions, but only if-then answers. But the key message is that spatial factors interact and interact with social factors to alter the vulnerability of locations of different kinds of crime, but they do it in predictable ways. We can get a handle on it. So the study, of which you've been seeing some of the data, is in an area made up of 263,000 people, over 100,000 dwellings, and 65,000 residential buildings, 536 kilometres of road made up of 7,000 odd segments, many segments and sub-centres, many you wouldn't take the kids to on a Saturday afternoon, I have to say, over 13,000 burglaries and over 6,000 street robberies. So it's quite a substantial database. And we're going to talk about residential burglary and street robbery, as these are the two crimes that people most worry about. Now, we created crime data tables at several levels. The highest level is the 21 wards of about 12,000 people that make up the borough. At this spatial data is numerically accurate, but only reflects the broadest characteristics of the area. We also have social data from the 2001 census, including the sort of famed deprivation index. But patterns at this level are at best broad and scene setting. The next level is 800 output areas, which are made up of about 125 dwellings from the 2001 census. So social data is rich and includes full demographic, occupation, social deprivation, unemployment, population, housing distance, ethnic mixes, as well as house types and forms of tenure. It's a very, very rich database. But unfortunately, at this level, the spatial data is fairly meaningless because of the way people have drawn these things to somehow draw them around 125 dwellings. So they're completely inconsistent, often in a spatial sense. The next level is the 7,000 odd street segments. Here we have extremely powerful spatial data, very good physical data. We have data on what are called council tax boundaries, which indicate property values, which we use as a surrogate. But at this level, we can't get access to the full demographic and social data. And then finally, we have a data table of individual residential buildings, 65,000 of them. And here, spatial values are taken from the associated segment. And again, we have the surrogate data and physical data. So we can't make, if you like, the best social data quite meet with the best spatial data, but by working across levels, we'll show you how we're able to deal with this. Now, let me just give a health warning. The database is very large, but it is confined to one region of London, and the findings must be reproduced in other studies for us to be sure they have any generality, even in one country. We are doing this now in another city. Having said this, the area in question is large and highly differentiated in terms of social composition and urban type, from inner city to suburban. This will allow spatial propositions to be tested by subdividing the data, for example, into the wards, which have very, very different social and spatial characteristics. So we can begin to partition the data in different ways, if you like, to at least to test whether different propositions hold under different kind of physical and social conditions. Let's begin by looking at some broad brush scene setting at the level of these large things, the walls. What I've done here is that I've taken the deprivation index, high deprivation, through to low deprivation, and I simply plotted, if you like, residential burglary rates, normalized residential burglary rates against this. Here I've done exactly the same for street robbery. I'm doing this only to show that the patterns of street robbery, although there is a very generalized fall from here to here and from here to here, the pattern is such that as to not allow us at all to talk about high crime and low crime areas, but different kinds of crime seem quite specific to different areas, even when we're painting with a broad brush in this sense. Here again, I'm taking this is the rank order of the burglary rates, residential burglary rates, and I've superimposed the robbery rates. Here I've done the same thing for the 800 upward areas. So you can see we have to be very, very careful, if you like, to talk about different crimes specifically rather than all at once. Now, what we find statistically, in fact, is that robbery responds to social deprivation far more linearly than burglary does. There is more robbery in socially disadvantaged areas, but burglary, in terms of socioeconomic groupings, are U-shaped. If we plot burglary rates against this property value index, if you like, the council tax band, we find it's highest in the most in the least affluent areas, and then comes down to the middle classes, if you like, and then begins to rise again for the affluent, as we use again and again in the more detailed data. And what we find that is at the ward level is that six of the wards, which are all around here, have markedly higher rates of burglary than all the others. And they're all contiguous to each other in the kind of 19th century urban part of the thing, which is half gentrifying, half poor, half mobile population. None of this will be very unfamiliar to you. What I've done here is I've plotted from red through to green. Red means the affluent, if you like, through to blue, who are the least affluent. The blue bits are the industrial areas, without residents. So you can see, if you like, the pattern, if you like, physically. And we can see this part has a mixed population. In fact, again, it's not very surprising. Multivariate analysis on the six wards with markedly high residential burglary have significantly smaller households, lower rates of owner occupation, the highest rates of converted flats, the lowest rates of residents at ground level, the greatest incidence of basements, they're in more spatially accessible locations, that means in the urban south and east rather than the more suburban north and west. Three of the six are centred on strong town centres, while the other three are in more upmarket residential areas adjacent to these. They're not socially homogeneous. They cover most of the range on mean tax bands. On the ratio of top levels of employment to lowest types, and on the managerial jobs against repetitive jobs, they include the three highest as well as the three lowest. They're not particularly high on unemployment or low parent households. What we're seeing is a complex process about how people select to live in, this is part of London where it's not exactly gentrification, it's where people who are upwardly mobile professionals who prefer to live in an urban setting are setting up home and also quite a high mobile population. So if you like, we're seeing, if you like, a pattern which is embedded in a social process. Now if we come down a level to the output area level of 125 houses about, the pattern of burglary rates from red for high through to blue for low is quite puzzling, because high and low rates seem to be often arbitrarily juxtaposed. This has been noticed before. It hardly even reflects the shift from 19th century urban housing to 20th century suburban housing in this area. Now, if we do analyse the output area data, where we've got the most disaggregated and fairly complete social and demographic data, stepwise regression on the whole database, taking all precautions on distributions into correlations with respect to residential burglaries. That's rather unexpected story. The deprivation index seems to sweep up all the social and demographic effects. And what are highlighted are simple physical factors of dwelling types and densities. We do find an increase in burglary with social deprivation. But we find a strong effect from housing type, with purpose-built flats and terrace houses beneficial, and converted flats and flats in commercial buildings vulnerable. We also find, which is much more surprising, a decrease in burglary rates with increased housing density, and also people density, but housing is stronger, though the two correlate closely. Now these are pervasive and consistent. The first and second are known. The British Crime Survey showed some years ago that if you take social class into account in the multivariate analysis, you know, flats are the safest dwellings and detached houses are the least safe, although the raw data will have it the other way around. Here, the raw data seems to have it the other way around. Let's look at some of these things about dwelling types. Here we're taking our sample sizes are on the left here, and these are the burglary rates over 5 years. We can see immediately as we go from flats through to terraced houses to semis to detached houses, the rates fairly consistently rise. We also distinguish single occupancy from multiple. In fact, these rates are all lower than these, and that could be for two reasons. It could be that multiple burglaries are being reported as one, or it could be that burglars are taking one dwelling in a multi-occupancy place and in effect protecting the others. But this is something we really need to know, because that is an interesting contrast between occurrence and risk. Now, how far is this a product, if you like, of things like non-reporting? I think we can take it for granted that the general pattern is secure, because here we cover the whole range. But if we look at the tall blocks, these are all social housing blocks left over from the times when we thought high-rise housing was the answer for socially underprivileged housing. So we would think, well, maybe these low rates, the mean is 0.130, these very low rates are something to do with non-reporting. But everybody in these is in the B tax band, which is the second to lowest tax band. So let's for a moment discount these lower rates. Because
can I ask you what's in the denominator on your rate?
Sorry?
What the denominator is on your rate? Is that per dwelling unit or per population?
Per dwelling unit.
Okay.
Yes. If we go to medium fly stories, we have got the full range of you know, poor to rich, if you like. And again, let's assume there may be some non-reporting down here. It doesn't seem to be very likely that it's here. And we do find more affluent people seem to be better at living in flats. Again, we find a similar pattern to begin with, though we do find a jump. But this doesn't get up to the higher tax bands at this level, so there's a bit of a gap in the data there. Now what we find with the terraces, even when we're dealing with small terraces, where the average is still well below, we're beginning to see the U-type again. We're beginning to see that the poorer have high rates and the richer have high rates. And we find it again here. We find almost a general U-shape, if you like, in all these things, as we move through the different types. And the rates get bigger, of course, as we raise the scale of the house. So what is clear is that two factors are involved in the shifting pattern of risk with respect to dwelling type. The simple physical facts of how many sides are you exposed. If you're in a semi-detached house, you're less exposed, if you like, than a detached house. If you're in a flat, you're less exposed than anything. So that's one factor. Houses are more at risk than flats, more so as they become detached. And the better off you are, the more you are at risk in a house and safer in a flat. I live in the Barbican in London, and having moved from a house where I was burglarized about five times in 5 years, and the Barbican with its 2,000 flats recently had its first burglary in 3 years. I mean, the differences in rates is quite incredible. So there are social factors here, and there's a physical factor working together. And they do seem to, you know, account for a great deal of the variance. Now, these results suggest that density may be a factor. And I'm rather suspicious of our result on output areas, because these are, again, arbitrarily shaped, and there's a lot of open space in them. and this could be biasing the results. But again, we can switch levels between our data sets and begin to ask questions. So what we did, we took the individual dwellings data set, and for every dwelling in the borough, we created a variable of how many other dwellings are in part or wholly within 30 metres of each dwelling. In other words, we have a dwelling-centred measure of density from there rather than an area base. Yes. We then use logistic regression to see if how far a lower or higher value of this variable affects the likelihood of the dwelling being burgled at least once. But of course, we lose information on repeats. Again, it tells us loud and clear that ground-level density, higher density, is highly beneficial, but that upper-level residential density is disbeneficial. We also find, strangely, and I don't really understand this, we find that in this condition, the not having non-residents within the buffer is also beneficial, which is very unexpected. Now, this is very robust, and we are dealing with 60,000 residential buildings here. And when we split it into single and multiple occupation dwelling types, it does survive. Now, to test this, we split the data three ways. First of all, by the 21 wards, to see if it holds in all of these very different kinds of conditions. Then by dwelling type, to see if it holds there. And then by the council tax band, which is the value of the house. On the first, we find that high density at ground level reduces vulnerability substantially in 20 out of 21 wards. And in 19 cases, the relation is statistically significant. In the other, it's weak. In the one case, the relation is not found, the result is statistically insignificant. So in spite of the result seems to hold, in spite of the great social, economic, demographic, and morphological variation, physical and area type across the borough. We then split the data by dwelling type, and again we find the relation holds for all dwelling types taken separately, except all terraces. And again, splitting by tax band, we again find the whole relation holds in all levels with high statistical significance, except in the very small sample of high top tax band cases. So there does seem to be a relation in this data between higher ground level density and lower burglary, but a worrying pattern is beginning to appear from what I've been saying. You're safer if you live in a flat, but you seem to increase the risk of those locally living in houses. There could be a simple statistical effect here. If flats are harder targets, as they seem to be, then within an area that is being targeted, the higher the proportion of harder flat targets, the greater the risk to the smaller proportion of easier target houses on the ground. So I think by Ockham's razor, we may have to accept this is likely. So what about the relationship of burglary to movement then? Is it, like density, perhaps a more complex relation than we thought? I think it is. Now, most studies have concluded that proximity to movement increases risks and casts doubt on Jane Jacobs' belief that passing strangers are more eyes on the street. The key argument is that if you are located in an accessible location with strong movement, then you're more likely to rely on the burglar search path, and I'm sure this is often the case. But syntactic studies have also shown quite unambiguously that within residential areas, the most important roads for movement are often the safest and have lower rates. So can we reconcile these different findings? Well, we can do simple things and use the burglar or not logistic regression on the movement variables. And the pattern we find suggests that both are right. Remember, we can set the radius of movement at a large scale or a small scale. By setting it at the whole city scale, we find what I call the accessibility component, if you like, is prejudicial. The through movement is much, much less so, although it's still significant. And I think this makes sense, because I think if you're on a search path here, this doesn't depend on people being there, but in fact it will be aided by these having relatively low rates of through movement. But when we come down to 300 metres, this becomes almost negligible, and we find that small-scale movement becomes beneficial. Again, this is small-scale through movement is beneficial. So what the data is suggesting, and we can do this with slightly different radii, what it seems to be saying is that, I think it's quite common sense, that if we're adjacent to large-scale movement on main arteries of some kind, then that is problematic. But if we're in the roads which are organising, if you like, the local patterns of movement, this is actually a Jane Jacobs-type benefit. And I'm fairly sure that this is the only way we should explain the kind of pattern of results that we've got and why we've had these two apparently contradictory things, which I think can be reconciled. Now, this suggests we need to look at the space structure more closely, and I want to look at the level of the street segment now rather than the individual building. And to do this, we have to talk about methodology and talk about the problem of a rate. If I'm going to be talking about a group of houses on a segment, then we need to have some conception, if you like, of a rate of burglary or rate of robbery. Now, the problem is this. Supposing there's a random process of assigning burglaries to houses, say numbering the houses and selecting the burglar ones by a random number selector. As the process proceeds, we'll find that whatever spatial unit we choose, then over time the number of burglaries on that spatial unit will be proportionate to the number of targets, of course. So it will appear that there's more burglary on units with more targets, and a random result might appear like a hotspot. If we try to get over this by establishing a rate, that is by dividing the number of burglars into the target, then we find the inverse problem, that for a significant part of the process, the rate will appear to be lower on units with more targets, since random events occurring will be dividing into a larger denominator. Of course, in the long run, the process is infinitely iterated. The number of burglars will be perfectly proportional to the number of targets, but in that case, we don't need this any other information. So it gives rise to two illusions, if you like. This is plotting pure counts, if you like, of burglary against the numbers of residents on the segment, and this is dividing it into the numbers. So we get one illusion this way and another artifact the other way. And the same thing with robbery, because again, for robbery, the key variable is not the number of targets there, but simply the length of the segment. A very daft idea. The longer the segment, the higher the risk in principle. And I'll show you in a moment this is the case. We need to solve this problem because the segment as a spatial unit is critical to the measures. And there'd be great gains if we can link spatial descriptors to crime figures at this disaggregated level. But how can we do it? Now, from our reasoning is this. From the point of view of the occurrence of burglary or robbery on segments, the number of targets on that segment is what we call the primary risk factor for burglary, as the length of the segment is the primary risk factor for burglary. And by primary risk factor, we mean that a distribution that arose from a random assignment process would produce a pattern which, with higher rates on those which were either had more targets or which were longer. And I suggest that no analysis of spatial units will be relevant unless it builds in a solution to the primary risk problem. Now, I think the problem can be solved by aggregation. If we take all the segments with a given number of targets and count all the burglars on those segments and divide into the total number of targets, we no longer have the denominator problem. We have a true rate, but only at the aggregate level. We can do the same thing with robbery. So let's explore what we mean by primary risk band analysis on the 400-odd kilometres of road made up of 4,000-odd segments. So primary risk band analysis means taking all the segments with a given number of dwellings, counting the total number of residences and the total number of burglaries and dividing one into the other. So the number of dwellings on the segment is not now involved in the calculation. The number of dwellings on the segment is a condition of that aggregate. Now what we find is if we take, there are 328 segments with exactly one dwelling, which have on average 3.15 non-residential units, we find there's been a total of 197 residential burglaries that have occurred over 5 years, which is a rate of over 60% or 12% a year, compared with an overall average in the data of 3.37 a year. If we take the 24 segments with more than 90 dwellings per segment, we find a total of 3,700 odd and 419 burglaries over 5 years, a 5-year rate of 11.3% or 2.26 a year. In other words, only about 20% of the other rate. So if we then divide all segments into bands according to their numbers of dwellings, okay, we're imagining we're creating a very, very long street made up of all these other these segments of streets, yes? An average of 94 segments per band with an average total length of 9.3 kilometres and an average of 1,600 dwellings per band in this thing, yes? We can then plot the true rates for each band and plot them on a line chart with dwellings per segment on the horizontal axis and burglary rates on the vertical. And it shows absolutely clearly this sort of continuous drop as you increase the numbers of dwellings per segment. You can also express it as a simple regression, if you like, in which case the R squared is 0.78. Now, I think this is very important. It does suggest that simply having more neighbours, if you like, on your segment is a source of safety. Well, we can first visualise this. What I've done is I've taken my map of this segment map of the area and I've coloured up. Red means lots of neighbours on the segment, through to blue meaning least on the segment. So you can see that in certain grid-like residential areas, you've got lots of neighbours. In certain high-street areas, you have very, very small numbers of neighbours. So is this another effect of the density that I saw before? Well, we can easily test this because we can put this variable into the logistic regression, and it turns out that both are affecting things separately. So if you like, the two-dimensional density of dwellings around you and the number on your line both seem to be playing independent effects. So why should you be safer on lines with more residences on them? One possibility is surveillance, of course, and that may be partly true. But I have a suspicion that recently Kate Bowers showed that a burglary in an area was likely to lead to others soon afterwards. There was a kind of a time pattern, if you like, to burglary. And I suspect there may be a saturation effect. This process doesn't go on forever, but it stops after a certain number of burglars being committed. In other words, there's a kind of periodicity in these little clusters that burglars carry out. And if this were the case, then there would be, if you like, the effect that I would find would be, again, a purely statistical effect from this this burglars process. But either way, there does seem to be safety in numbers argument here, which is quite important. Now, this is consistent with the space syntax theory of cities, in which residential blocks normally have larger block sizes to spread lower levels of movement over fewer spaces. Small block sizes occur not in residential areas, but in life centre areas, where small blocks facilitate ease of movement from all parts to all others. And this is something which designers are going to have to learn, because at the moment they're trying to make highly permeable kind of housing layouts. So let's move on to look at the issue of layout more closely, because if you like, all layouts are eventually made up of segment connections, and there's a lot of research which actually shows relationships between crime and this. So a one connected segment must be the end of a cul-de-sac. A six connected segment is going to be something like a grid. And again, we can look at we can plot our segments again in terms of segment connectivity. So we can see quite a lot of the ones that have lots of line neighbours also have high segment connectivity as well. Now, these are very unevenly distributed in the data. You've only got 81 one-connected segments and 400 or two-connected. Nearly everything is 3, 4, and 5-connected. But the 6-connected still account for about 4,000 dwellings. And if we compare this with the number of dwellings per segment, we can find there's a lot of similarity. But of course, here we find highly connected segments associated with very small numbers of residents. Now, I think, again, this is quite crucial. It tells us something very simple about cities. But if we set the mean length of segments against connectivity for purely residential streets, we get an increase in connectivity with length. But if we take those that include non-residential functions, we find a drop. In other words, segments become shorter as they become more significant. It's fundamentally true of cities. I bet it's true of Los Angeles, as well as most European cities. And if we then plot our segment connectivity against dwellings per segment, we find that we have high rates of dwellings per segment for highly connected segments, and we find very low connectivity. We find very high connectivity for very small numbers of dwellings per second. I confuse myself here, I'm sorry. So we get very small numbers on grid-like things in the busy areas, and in the residential areas we get large numbers of people. So, and if we plot these risk bands against spatial accessibility, again we find we've got dwellings, if you like, high numbers of dwellings per segment with high spatial accessibility, and we find very small numbers of dwellings per segment with high accessibility as well. So when we plot one against the other, we plot burglary rates against this variable, we find a bifurcation, you know, which, and if we split the data, in fact, according to Witherall, it's around 25 units. If you take the, these are the segments with less than 25 residences on them, and we find that risk increases with spatial accessibility. If we take those with more than 25, we find that risk reduces with accessibility. Again, this seems to explain the findings that we find, that people often find that in residential areas, that the most important streets are the safest, but at the same time, living in through not too far from a main road can be highly problematic. Another thing we find is that if we look at mixed-use areas, what this again is taking dwellings per segment. These are the purely residential segments, and we can see that burglary rates, which are on the vertical axis, fall all the way along. If we take the in circles, we take the segments with 1 to 4 non-residential units, we find this. If we take any number, we find this. What this is telling us is that if we have very small numbers of residents, there's a very high penalty to being in a mixed-use area. The risks of crime are very, very greatly increased. As you increase the number of residents, if you like, the residential density, then this penalty all but disappears. The lines converge on each other. In other words, it's saying that, of course, mixed-use increases the rate of crime, but with a high residential numbers and high residential culture, then this tends to disappear. We also find that the old debate about cul-de-sacs, we do find in this data that 1 or 2 connected segments, which will be cul-de-sacs, have lower rates, slightly lower rates than other segments. But again, there's a much more complex story, and the key variable is the number of dwellings per segment. If we take the average for all cul-de-sacs is a 0.105 rate for 5 years against 130 for all segments, but cul-de-sacs with no more than 10 dwellings have a rate of 209. While 6 connected grid-like segments with more than 100 dwellings have a rate of a 0.086. In other words, you can see that there's the dwellings per segment factor, the scaling, if you like, of the residential community, is more effective than the number of segment connections we have. And this interacts with social factors. We find that, essentially, that more affluent people cope much better with the well-scaled, mixed-use, grid-like layout than the less affluent. They tend to do better, if you like, on the more open grid-like layouts. But within cul-de-sacs, they become much more highly targeted. A small cul-de-sac with rich people in it. And I think it's a modification of the search hypothesis that we might conjecture the more attractive the target, the more the isolation of the cul-de-sac is, benefits the burglar. But for less attractive targets, cul-de-sacs tend to be off the search path, because they don't mean anywhere. So again, we can find different effects, if you like, according to what kinds of physical and spatial conditions that we have. I think I'm going to have to cut out a bit on robbery, because I think, let me just sort of close off now. This is why I think that some of the things that are being said by both sides of this debate are both right. But I do think there's one thing coming out of this data, which again, other data we have supports. And this is this safety in numbers argument, because there's been so much emphasis on small-scale spatial groupings as a means to reduce crime. And this seems to be completely wrong. We have to scale up, if you like, the residential culture, whatever part of the urban system you're in. So I think we have to raise the scale of what we mean by a residential area, rather than trying to go for these sort of these noddy land little kind of small-scale developments. Anyway, I do show you street robbery and show how the patterns differ and how, in fact, what happens is that although it looks as though everything is crowded on the main lines, in fact, it's not on the main lines that it happens. It's on lines with certain characteristics, with low visibility, low movement, adjacent to high movement lines. And we can begin to pin down exactly where the kind of high risk for robbery rates are. It ends up with saying, don't leave the high street before midnight and don't go on it after midnight. This kind of thing. So just dealing with the questions, does higher density reduce or induce crime? Ground level density in this data reduces crime. Upper level density seems to increase it. Mixed use, does it induce crime? Yes, but the stronger the residential culture, the less the increase, and the powerful residential culture neutralizes the risk. How permeable should residential areas be? enough to structure movement in all directions, but no more. Poorly used permeability increases crime risk. Do people passing by make you safer or more vulnerable? Proximity to large scale, aerial movement increases risk. The proximity to local movement within residential areas reduces it. Do social and economic factors interact with physical and spatial factors? Yes. Critically, including with the basic issues of dwelling type and layout type. Again, a health warning with this. This study shows how these questions can be answered, but these are not yet the answers, because this is only the first large-scale study, and we need some more.